this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey guys, let's start this episode with a... Please stop trying to interrupt me.
Why do we do that? Why does it happen every time?
You love going first, man.
We need to start like setting this up ahead of time. Like,
you would actually think that we would rehearse. We need some to start, element of this.
You know, now that we're how many years into this, we should start planning what we're going to do.
You know what I just saw? I saw we have 273. This will be the 274th episode. Oh, 274 wow. Episodes. That's a lot of beer, Wheeler.
Yeah. So if we were a sitcom, I think we've talked about this before a long time ago. If we were a sitcom, which some might argue that occasionally we are, we would be able to fully go into syndication, and you and I would be receiving what they call mailbox money, where you get those royalties that just keep arriving.
And yet here we are, neither a sitcom nor any mailbox money coming into our houses. But let me start this episode with a stat. I saw this the other day. I get a lot of stuff in my inbox, and this one came across, and I almost hit delete. I said, whoa, this would be good for Wheeler. The average, this is from Zinnia Health, Z-I-N-N-I-A, Zinnia Health. I've heard of them, I think, but they put the study out. The average Texan thinks that 2:36 p.m. is an acceptable time for a first drink.
2:36 p.m.
2:36 p.m. No, I know yours is about 7:30 in the morning, but the average Texan thinks that 2:36 p.m. One in three considers weekends and holidays a good excuse to drink earlier. 60% say they would not drink alone before 5 p.m., which blows you out of the water. And then almost half would confront a loved one if they noticed regular day drinking. Wow. Has Mrs. Wheeler said anything to you about
She has not, because the only time I regularly day drink is when I am doing this podcast.
With me, right?
Yeah, you're a bad influence, as my wife understands it, and she's not very far off there.
Here's the other thing I wanted to add to. Wyoming residents are ready. They drink the earliest in Wyoming. They're ready to toast at noon, claiming the title of the earliest drinkers in the nation. North Dakotans and Montanans are the most patient, waiting until 4:30 in the afternoon.
Wow. You know, maybe, and all of these sound really early to me. Maybe there's something wrong with me, though, because you hear me complain constantly about how I feel like I'm just, you know, busy out of my mind. Maybe I need to take a page out of everybody else's book and just slow down and crack one open in the middle of the day and just take it easy and think, you know what? If I don't make all of my deadlines at work, that's okay. They still have Whiteley. They can lean on him.
When you said maybe there's something wrong with me when you said that, I'm like, okay, well, where's this one going to go?
Wait, that could go a lot.
How much time do we have for this?
On that note, let me pop that top. Yeah.
What are you drinking today, by the way?
I am having an Austin East Cider's blood orange cider today.
Nice. Back at the fridge, or did Mrs. Wheeler buy that for you?
This was in the fridge. I like the Austin East Cider's pineapple a lot. Yeah. The pineapple cider there is really good, but I'm doing blood orange this time.
You are a fruity guy. You love that. I'm pulling one out from the fridge that I've had in here for
a
minute.
That's good.
Too.
This is summer beer right here. It's a good summer drink.
Yeah, that Austin East Ciders does have some good stuff. I'm drinking. This is in the fridge for a minute here. I have Tecate, and I have this one, and I just selected this one. It's a Pilsner, but it's from Hawaii.
Pauhana. Okay.
From the Maui Brewing Company.
Wow, that's cool.
In Hawaii, yeah. So
wow, exotic.
It kind of goes with, it tastes good. Kind of goes with something our guest said later in the podcast. We'll talk about that in a minute, though.
Wait, real quickly, though.
Yeah.
So right now you are popping the top on that. You realize that Hawaii beer, they're, you know, several hours before us. So
it's 7:22 a.m.
Early drinkers by their standards, you know.
It's Hawaii. Beer. Yeah, 7:22 in the morning there. like all of us, we've been watching the Donald Trump trial, the one with Stormy Daniels and the so-called hush money. We're also watching the news about the other trial, the one in Georgia, and then the secret documents case. Those have been postponed for a while.
And the January 6th one in D.C.
So there's a lot going on out there. But you and I have talked about this kind of privately, how, You know, if this were to happen to anybody else, they would be completely blown out of the water politically. Their career would be over with. Not Donald Trump, though. He, Teflon Bill is what they call Clinton for a long time. But Trump just completely blows that away. The amount of stuff that voters forgive him for.
Yeah, things don't stick. And even though there are groups out there, including the group that we're talking about today, the Lincoln Project, that have tried very hard to stick a lot of different things to him, these things just don't stick with his supporters. Now, here's the thing. They're not trying, places like the Lincoln Project, they're not going out there and trying to convince everyone in the MAGA movement to abandon Donald Trump and consider him toxic. They have given up on a lot of those voters as far as trying to encourage them or to persuade them. They are honing in on a sliver of the electorate. I keep wondering all the time, Jason, as we look at polls and stuff in this election year, who still hasn't decided? I mean, these two candidates who are the presumptive nominees for the major parties have been around forever and a day. They've held office. We know what their policies are. We know what kind of people they are. Like, who's still sitting on the fence? Like, I don't know, if I could just see another ad, it might, push me over the line. But the Lincoln Project has actually identified a fair number of people who they believe are totally persuadable in this election. And that's who they're going after.
Yeah, several hundred thousand people in four specific states. We're going to get into that in a minute. Here's what I like most about this interview. We try to get into strategy a lot. We try to talk about, get people to open up about kind of the mechanics of how politics works and how campaigns work. And sometimes they do. This conversation today in this episode, though, really kind of pulls the curtain back on how all this happens, how it's happened for previous campaigns. And that's what I like so much about it. I cracked up at several points in here. Mm-hmm. Our guest today, let's get right to it. Our guest today, Stuart. I almost said Stuart Evans. It's Stuart Stevens. Mm-hmm. He's a senior advisor with the Lincoln Project, but he has a heck of a political resume. He worked with Mitt Romney's campaign. He worked with Rob
George
Portman,
W. Bush, I think.
George W. Bush, Roy Blunt in Missouri, Dan Coats in Indiana. You name it, he's worked with a lot of them. He's also into film. He's he skied to the North Pole. This is a real Renaissance man, but he's really on the inside of the Lincoln Project, kind of at the heart of what they're doing and trying to do. And we called him up and got him on the phone to find out a number of things. But first of all, I think we're most curious about whether this Trump trial in New York that's still going on right now, whether it's going to impact anything. So we start right there, but then we get into politics pretty fast. If you've seen Stuart in other interviews, sometimes he likes to take a left turn or, go out on a limb on some different things. And we let him in this interview.
Yeah, sometimes the turns are where the really interesting stuff is. So we will, by all means, let somebody take the wheel and take us on some unexpected turns. So take a listen now. Here's Stuart Stevens.
Hey, y'all. This is where Texas politics gets interesting. For another smart conversation on Eolitics.
Hey, Stuart, thanks for being here. We got to talk about the criminal trial that's ongoing here. Stormy Daniels back on the stand again as we record this podcast here. But we have a presidential candidate who is in a criminal trial, and he is still a viable candidate, which tells me that this is helping his campaign and helps the victim mentality that he's been so successful at portraying here. Do you see this continuing if there's a conviction, or if he's freed? I would think this would really help him.
I had a going out of business sale of any optimism in the Republican Party. So let's just say that, any idea they might rise up and do the right thing, I just, I sold all that. I think that there is something deeply disturbing to people about seeing this happen. And the details are tawdry. I mean, it's like you're saying, if I woke you up in the middle of the night, 9 years ago and said, hey, guys, there's a guy from Queens who's out on bail, who is a Republican nominee, who's on trial for having sex with a porn star and paying her hush money before the election, not long after his youngest son was born. How do you think he's doing? And by the way, that's one of three four criminal counts he has against him, four criminal charges. I mean, I don't think any of us would say, hey, look, this dude's got it in the bag. It's mm-hmm. over. I don't know why anybody's going to run against him. I have a theory. Now, it's somewhat unburdened by evidence, but that in the mid-October, October 20th, something like that, I think Trump may collapse. You know, I go back and I was looking at all the data on Jimmy Carter and Reagan in 80. And I think it might happen in reverse, that the challenger may collapse. Hmm. You know, I liken it to somebody walking around with a paper bag full of water. It doesn't leak, but it's really hard to get it back once it goes. So I don't think this, you can only vote once. So I think, you know, Trump has tremendous intensity. But if you look at the primary, it was almost a threshold question that you had to believe that the White House was stolen to vote for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that, I forget, the varied state to state, but, you know, it was north of 70% pretty consistently. And, you know, the country just isn't there. But
Stuart, what would cause a collapse, though? Trump has survived everything that's ever been thrown at him politically, except for Joe Biden in 2020. What would cause a collapse now?
I think it would be a number of factors, which is what usually happens in politics. You know, there is no policy that the Republican Party has. I don't know what the bargain is that they're offering. Okay, I vote for Republican. What do I get? You know, there's no tax plan. There's no jobs plan. There's no health care plan. There's just nothing there except stuff he wants to take away. He wants to take away student loans. He wants to take away reproductive rights. And I think that is a very hollow campaign. I mean, you know how it is, guys. We walk into a presidential campaign. I've done five of these things. You know, there's usually like a part of the headquarters where you're like, who are those people? And they go, well, they're all like Rhodes Scholars and Supreme Court clerks. and they're producing like more paper than the Renaissance, you know, and these binders and these books, you know. Well, those people aren't in the Trump. That doesn't exist in the Trump campaign. And I think that the effort that Trump does to make it about you really bumps up against those who don't feel that they're victims, who don't wake up in the morning feeling aggrieved. And I think that really limits his appeal.
Stuart, I would imagine you guys are going to be really busy heading into October, and especially in the culmination of this in November. I know in the last presidential cycle, you all spent something like $47 million or so, going against Republicans and promoting Democrats and making it a real stark choice for people. You did all of these hard hitting ads. You guys have continued to do those. Yeah. You all haven't spent as much this time around. Does that mean that the onslaught is yet to come? And if so, where does that onslaught go? Where do we see you on TV? Do we see it on, you know, social media? Where are you targeting people?
That's a fantastic question. So, you know, in 2020, we talked a lot about what we call Bannon line voters. And that came from the wonderful human being, Steve Bannon, saying that if these guys could get 5 to 6, 7% of Republicans to vote for Biden, there'd be a real problem. So we took that as our mission. And what's unique about the Lincoln Project is these are people we know. I mean, you know, I've done governor's races in all these states or Senate races. You know, these are people we had to appeal to. Since then, we've done a tremendous amount of research into these voters and some very interesting research efforts. And we have it targeted how many there are in each state. We divide the majority of them. They sort of fell into two categories. It's really fast. What we call Dobbs dads and moms. And those are, they tend to be more male than female. They tend to have a disproportionate number of them tend to have daughters. And a not small number of them would check a box saying that they were pro-life. But they hate the idea of liberties being taken away. They hate the idea that, you know, if their daughter was raped at, you know, 12 years old, that she would have to, you know, she'd be a criminal. And that's repugnant to them. And this other group we call Red Dawn Conservatives, after that old movie, remember, about the Soviets invading?
Yeah.
Wolverines. And these are older voters. They're more Reagan Republicans. And there's a lot about Trump they like. But the idea that we would be on the same side as Putin is just so mind-boggling to them that it just, I can't do this. And those are the two groups that we are targeting on. And if you take like the whole abortion issue, there are many, many groups out there that are doing very powerful jobs. And you see it in, at the ballot box, talking about this issue, that are traditional Democratic groups. We come at it from a different way. They talk a lot about abortion. We talk a lot about taking rights away. And if you look at these referendums, like in Kansas, that was the roadmap to success in Kansas. That, once they take this away, they'll take something else away. And there's a weird kind of Venn diagram that people are against this because they think it may affect their Second Amendment rights. They're going to take this away. Why not, we take that away? People like to wake up in the morning and not think about the government, not worry about what mood the president's in. I mean, who wants that? And that's one of the things about Trump. He's just constantly in your face. He demands that you think about it. And that's very tiring and it's exhausting. So those are our voters. Our top four states are Pennsylvania, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Michigan. If depending on how the race is going, and I have some feeling the Pennsylvania may break decisively for Biden. I worked for the last Republican governor there to get reelected, Tom Ridge, and I know the state pretty well. They have a very popular Democratic governor, Josh Shapiro. They have a very good organization that involved a lot of Republicans who couldn't vote for the Republican nominee for governor or couldn't vote for Oz. So that if that falls off, we spend a lot of time looking at data. If you go down to the South, would North Carolina be more open or Georgia? And it's like a lot of things in life. I could kind of argue it both ways. And the answer is we don't know yet. I think if we had an African-American Senate candidate again on the ballot, I would say Georgia. But we don't. And you have this nut job who is a Democratic nominee in North Carolina. North Carolina also, I find this fascinating. Of all the southern states, it has experienced the most rapid growth of Hispanic voters. And a lot of reasons for that. Some we don't understand, but it's a fact. For all the talk of Trump doing better with Hispanic voters, I think at the end of the day, he's not going to get north of 35%.
Is it a waste of y'all's time or effort to focus it all on Texas? Do you guys have plans?
Well, as in 2000, when I was doing Bush debate prep, I heard that there was this, world-class college debater working for the campaign, a guy named Ted Cruz. And I was like, guys, why is this guy not helping us? And universally the answer was, have you met him? Then I did. It's like, oh yeah, this isn't gonna work. No. I find Cruz just a very weird, strange character. I honestly don't know enough about Texas, but I will make a prediction. The day Texas goes for a Democratic president is the day Republicans are going to want to abolish the Electoral College. Because if they can carry California, Democrats, and Texas, it's game over.
Yeah, they'll never get back to the White House without the largest Republican state here. You laid out a lot there, and I had questions about, the strategy you're talking about, with the dads and daughters and then the Red Dawn, the Wolverines crowd. Let me go back to that for a minute. How many of those do you think exist And when you say targeting them, it sounds like you have data to know where they are, at least in those four states, Arizona, you know, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan.
Yeah, just bear with me for a second. I can get very nerdy. In Arizona, our target is 104,647 voters. 44,622 fall into the Dobbs category. 59,025 fall into Red Dawn conservatives. In Michigan, it's 406,601. 290,500 in Dobbs, 170,101 in Red Dawn. Wisconsin, 201,352, 127,350 Dobbs, 168,702 Red Dawn conservatives. In Pennsylvania, it's 425,200 overall. And for some reason, I don't have the breakdown here on the sheet of Red Dawn.
But wow, yes, that's much bigger than the margin of victory in all of those states the last time around. That sounds like a group that's ripe for the picking then.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that that banning line has expanded, right? I mean, it seems not unlikely that, you know, 25 years from now, this is going to be known as a sort of Dobbs era of politics. And the way it's affecting all of our politics, I think, is consistently underappreciated. You know, there's a lot of quirks to polling on abortion. And one thing, people traditionally, if you can use that word, is, you know, they don't really like to talk about abortion. I mean, nobody, you know, somebody calls you up and says, I want to talk to you about abortion. You go, great. Been waiting all day for this, you know. It makes it difficult to poll. And this is why I think you've seen disparities in these elections where the Democrats end up doing better than their polling. And I think this group has definitely grown. I think it's growing every day. I think, you know, Stormy Daniels being on the stand does nothing but grow that. You know, one of the things we found, which fascinates me, but our most effective messages have been, is this who you are? You know, put up a Marjorie Taylor Greene. You know, is this really who you are? You really want to be this angry person who's mad at the world? I mean, you really want to be like the guy in the Camp Auschwitz sweatshirt in the Capitol, you know, some guy with a Confederate flag. And people rebel against that. I mean, they find that repugnant. No. You know, I think Trump, remember in 20 when he made a push to try to scare suburban voters about non-whites or, you know, non-Christians moving into the suburbs. And I think it backfired because, I mean, we know, you know, tons of people that live in the suburbs. And, you know, not all, but I mean, overwhelmingly, I think if they're white and a non-white family moved in next door or a different religion, they would go out of their way to welcome them, to show their kids, this is what we do. I mean, that it's just that America doesn't really exist anymore. If I ran the Democratic Party, I would wake up, God forbid, but I would wake up every day trying to get in a culture war. Because it seems to me the Republican Party is at war with the modern world. You know, like, how'd that thing go in attacking Nike and Colin Kaepernick? Nike made $9 billion. You know? I mean, remember when they were in a fight with NASCAR because NASCAR wanted to ban the Confederate flag? And so I just woke up and said, like, how do you get, are you Republicans and you're in a culture war with NASCAR? Like, really? I guess Ron DeSantis is at war with the Happiness Company? Like, how does that? Really?
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable where we are right now. But let me get back to something that Jason, the other Jason asked here. I like to call him the other Jason since I'm the Jason.
We were told to call him that, by the way. You know. Yeah.
but you mentioned those four states, you know, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and the targeted group there. And you said, you know, we'll deal with Texas when Texas gets a little closer, maybe. I think it's kind of what you intimated there. But is that where the Lincoln Project's really going to spend a lot of its time, money, and focus? Those four states, those hundreds of thousands of voters you mentioned there between now and November?
Yeah. You know, the Lincoln Project really works on two levels. There is this very specific ballot box, call it, purpose that we have. And, you know, with digital targeting now, the ability to target people and the ability to target areas with geofencing is so precise. I mean, it's sort of frightening, but it is unbelievably efficient. Much more, you know, I grew up buying ads on television cable. And then, you know, the way we used to buy digital was very crude. We do like search engine stuff, but we couldn't target the voters the way we can now. So we are starting a campaign to reach these voters digitally in waves. We're going to go after women first, because there's a lot of data that shows if the preponderance of impact of a female in the household being for a candidate. And, you know, you can at least try to work that out. But the other impact we have is on national narrative. And, you know, Twitter's a mess and everything, but still, we have an ability to set a narrative in the campaign. I'll give you a perfect example. And, you know, in 2020, and I can say this without any false modesty, because I wasn't part of the Lincoln Project at the time. So you remember, you know, 2020 rolled around, they were going into these debates. There was a very legitimate school of thought that the race shouldn't be about Donald Trump. What are you going to say about Donald Trump? Change anybody's mind. I mean, no human on the planet doesn't have an opinion. Elizabeth Warren articulated that very well, the way she does. The Lincoln Project, you know, these guys, they looked at it and go, no, that's wrong. Donald Trump is the first issue, the second issue, the third issue, the first 100 issues. And they said that at a time when Joe Biden was out there losing primaries. And then he, you know, had that sort of miraculous 48-hour turnaround. And his soul of the nation message really blended with the Lincoln Project. I mean, our line was America or Trump. You have to choose. And I think that there's three keys to this election. Biden has to represent the future. And I think that he can do that. I mean, both of them are the last president we're going to have born in the shadow of World War II. That's a given. Both are going to be the oldest president. But Biden has policy that is much more focused on the future to help people. He has one of the youngest administrations in history. And Trump is all about the past. I mean, like right now, he's litigating what happened in a hotel room in the past. I mean, it, you know, there's just this fantasy, the return to a world in which it never existed.
But poll after poll, you know, especially in these swing states, has shown Donald Trump ahead of Biden. Now, the margins are close in a lot of cases, but they consistently keep showing him ahead. If you had the ear of President Biden or his campaign team, I mean, you guys hit hard in your ads. Are they hard enough? Are they doing enough? Is there somewhere where they need to switch direction here? You've worked on campaigns.
I'll answer that one, Stuart. No, it's not hard enough. The Democrats don't hit hard enough. That's why the Lincoln Project's here. But go ahead, Stuart. You fill in the details. You
know, one of the things I realized when I started working for the Lincoln Project is how liberating it was not to have a candidate. Because, you know, if you make an ad calling your opponent a liar and run it, and then, you know, your candidate gets asked by, you know, one of the Jasons, you think your opponent's a liar, you damn well better say yes. So you got a real problem, you know. And we could go out there to, you know, people say, what was the process that you guys did in the Lincoln Project? We didn't have a process. I mean, Rick Wilson and I, we get up in the morning, we decide what to do, we do it, we put it up. We didn't test a thing, we didn't focus group, we didn't have to go before any kind of steering committee, we didn't have to show it to a candidate, their spouse, their uncle. We just put it up. And nobody went to Joe Biden and said, how did you let these lunatics put up a billboard of Ivanka and Jared in Times Square, basically accusing them of murder? You know, we could do it, and Biden wasn't responsible for it. And that, I think Democrats should hit harder. Don't get me wrong. But I will say it is easier for us, which is really what's unique about the Lincoln Project. You know, most super PACs, if one disappeared, they'd be replaced by another. But our origin story is so unique that we don't belong to a party. We really are, in many ways, a single issue pro-democracy organization. Now, democracy is full of lots of issues. So when you're taking away reproductive freedom, that's an issue for democracy. So I will say this, I I think the Biden campaign ran a brilliant campaign in 2020. It is very difficult to beat an incumbent president. I've tried and failed. And here's a little nerdy data point. You know, after Watergate, presidential campaigns got the federal funding. And the way that worked was, for the general election, the way that worked is, if you agreed not to raise more money, when you won, accepted the nomination, like literally that night, walking back from the convention, you would get the same amount of money, both candidates. There's always somebody there from the Treasury Department with a check. And we're like, can you wire this? And they go, no, we do checks. We do checks. And that started in 76. And Obama blew the system up in 2008. So McCain stayed in the system. So Romney, Obama, was the first time both candidates were not in that system. If you haven't heard, Romney lost.
Because Obama, because Obama raised more money than that.
Well, you know, if you read David Plouffe's book, I gotta give him credit. In 2008, you know, Obama, like everybody, had said he'd stay in the system. It was just a given. And then David, when he wrote about it, was pretty honest, because we just realized we could raise like ungodly amounts of money. And we just stepped out of it. And, you know, there was something unique about the Obama candidacy that he could probably get away with that more than anybody else. And the history of campaign finance is, once you step out of a system, it's really hard to get the genie back in the bottle. Mm-hmm. So it's fair to ask, when is the last time an incumbent president, when both candidates weren't in the federal funding system, when is the last time an incumbent president lost? And it's Herbert Hoover. Mm-hmm. And he had a bad year. And so I have a lot of respect for the Biden campaign. I think they have this greatly underappreciated quality in politics that they are patient. Hmm. If I was working in the Biden campaign now, this is probably the reason I'm not, but anyway, I would be worried, this may sound crazy, about peaking too soon. Hmm. Because I think the roadmap for a Biden victory, most likely, to come out of the convention, be behind until the convention, get a lead in the convention, and then pour it on after that. Hmm. I get hinky thinking about, so that's a comeback story, right? Everybody loves a comeback story. I get hinky thinking about that happening twice. Hmm. That, you know, if Biden opened up a big lead and came down, I mean, he could do it, probably would, because Trump's such a, you know, horrible human being and candidate. But I think, you know, I'm not inside that campaign, and you really, that's one thing I've learned, you know, you really have to be, it's like being in a pro football locker room. I mean, you have no idea what's really going on unless you're there. And so.
Stuart, let me ask you a last question here. Time's flying on us, but last question I have for you is something you said the other day. In another interview, you said there's no Republican Party to go back to. Yep. And I'm curious what that means for center right Americans, for the Reagan Republicans, the Bush Republicans. And you said that 2032 is the best hope. Explain that.
That was probably a little over optimistic. I think a threshold question is, when is someone going to be the Republican nominee who says Donald Trump lost a free and fair election, that Donald Trump, say what the majority of people believe, that he lost that election, that he attempted to incite a riot to stop and successfully stop the peaceful transition of power. When are you going to have someone who's going to walk away from that? I sure can't see it happening in 2008. 28. Look at DeSantis, you know, he's got some smart people working for him, as does Trump. Trump has a much better campaign this time. And they decided the only path was to go to the right of Trump, you know, and politics is ultimately a market driven business. And you had two of my former clients, Chris Christie and Asa Hutchinson, out there offering another vision. Mm-hmm. How'd they do? No, not great. And, you know, for all you say about Nikki Haley, she stood up there and raised her hand and said she'd vote for Donald Trump, even if he was convicted. And I think her political career ended in that moment. So I think there is a deep, deep need for a center-right party. Now, one of the things I hope is happening is the Democratic Party is sort of becoming the party of strength again. I mean, it is a true statement that Bernie Sanders is to the right of many Republicans on Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Mind-boggling. I mean, you know, he honeymooned in Russia, but he didn't stay there. I just never thought I'd see that happen. And it was Nancy Pelosi that went to Taiwan, you know, and if you could get back to that, that kind of JFK image of the party. I mean, why did JFK want? There was a missile gap. You know, Nixon accused him of having a secret plan to invade Cuba. Turned out he was right. But, you know, I think that would be tremendously powerful if they could do that. And there is this generation of great war on terror vets that are candidates in the Democratic Party. Some in the Republican, but in the Democratic Party. And I look to them and say, this is the future of the Democratic Party. And so I think that there could be a resetting where the Democratic Party is more of a center party. It's fascinating. We got, you know, another whole conversation about what's happening, you know, on campuses and with Gaza and all of this. But, you know, overwhelmingly, these numbers show that most students don't agree. They don't want commencement shutdown. They want to graduate. I saw a stat the other day that blew my mind. There are 750,000 students in four-year private colleges in America. There are 8 million in community colleges.
Wow. Wow. That's huge. I have a couple of quick questions for you to close it out. Ted Cruz, you invoked his name. What do you see in his race? He's, you know, facing Colin Allred this time, Representative Allred, and the race was really close the last time around for Cruz. What do you see happening there?
You know, at a certain point, the quality of the candidate matters. And you know, I think Allred's a much better candidate than Cruz. Cruz is running a very defensive campaign. This is really, you guys know more about this than I do. You know, I have not studied Texas now. I'm not waking up in the morning looking at any polling or, and I will donate. I think I probably have donated to him. I'll donate more. Hope he wins. And I hope we live in a world in which those states we were talking about look pretty locked off from, you know, October 20th, and we're able to get into Texas.
Stuart, but, what do you do if, here's my final one, what do you do if Donald Trump pulls it off and he wins in November? What is your outlook? What's your personal plan if that happens?
You know, there was this moment, I wrote about it in this last book I wrote, Conspiracy to End America, about, you know, in the Lincoln Project, we all got together out in Park City for the last few months of the race. I'm not sure why we did, but we did. All I did was just make spots, you know, and we made over 300 videos. Mm-hmm. I can remember waking up like October 20th, one of these deals I've been like awake for three nights, you know how it is, and doing this stuff. And I'd done a lot of work in all these states, the Pennsylvania thing, and I was looking at data and I said, Biden's going to win this. I remember going to bed and saying, that's it. I can get out of this. And it was such a sense of relief. I started thinking about, like, I have this part of my life where I write. I started thinking about it. And then everything happened after the election. And, you know, I wrote that book. It was all a lie. The Republican Party became Donald Trump. But if you had asked me, would Republicans, overwhelmingly senators, if Donald Trump lost by 7 million and north of 300 electoral college votes, would they accept it? I mean, I would have looked at you like you're crazy. It's like walking out of the Super Bowl and debating the score. It's like, we know. Yeah, they won't like it. And the party just collapsed. I mean, think about it. You know, I mean, my dad fought in World War II. Part of that, 3 years in the South Pacific, Twin Eight Island landings, just came back like hundreds of thousands of others, never talked about. These guys and women did a legacy. They have the legacy of the greatest generation. And they can't get their comm shop to put out a statement congratulating the president-elect of the United States. I mean, think about how pathetic that is. Compared to, you know, it's a pretty low bar, you know, and I think it's a total collapse of the party, you know. And it, on a personal level, it's extraordinarily painful. I mean, when I, you know, wrote It Was All a Lie and went out and started talking about in 2020 the way you do, I remember somebody asked me just the most bland question, like, you know, what do you think happened to the Republican Party? And I found myself just getting very emotional. It was just so personal to me. I mean, I felt like these people had lied to me. I was like the guy working for Bernie Madoff that thought we were beating the market. It's like, what? You know, these were just marketing slogans, character counts, strong on Russia. And, you know, Chris Christie had been a longtime friend and client, did all his races, loved the guy. I can remember standing in Atlanta airport when he endorsed Donald Trump in 2016 and tears came to my eyes. I felt like I was watching somebody overdose. Now, he's back. He's in the right place now. But, you know, he did try to help reelect Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump tried to kill him with COVID and big debate prep. You know, he waited until January to try to kill Mike Pence. And I don't know. I don't know how it happened. Now, you know, there's some out there, Mitt Romney. But so many of these people that I thought I knew, and, you know, the way of the world, some of them became close friends, you know. I just never would have imagined it. And I don't think we've seen anything like it in American history, just a complete moral collapse of a party. And how do you rebuild that? I think the only way is that Republicans have to be convinced that they will lose with Trumpism. And pain is the only teacher in politics. And when that happens, and you have to beat Republicans over and over and over. And then ultimately parties tend to do what's in their self-interest. But you need people like Jeff Duncan, you know, the Lieutenant Governor of Georgia, who went out and said, it's easy to say I'm not going to vote for Trump. He went out and said, I'm going to vote for Biden, which is what Chris Christie has to do.
Yeah. You know what we're going to do, Stuart? We're going to call you maybe in October and see if you have one of those moments where you it all comes to you and you can predict the winner of the November election.
If you call and it's an overseas call, you'll know the answer. It's a small country, non-extradition treaty. Yeah, dude, like, that didn't exactly work out, huh? Like,
you know, might be on a list.
Yeah, okay. Right.
A&M's going to win the SEC and national championship. Didn't quite work out, huh?
Yeah, right. Stuart, man, that's great insight. I appreciate the history and the insight into kind of what's going on. And we always appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much for the time.
Okay. Appreciate everything you do.
We'll talk again, Stuart. Thank you.
Okay. All the best.
Okay, y'all. The conversation doesn't stop here. Find us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Yolitics.
All right, so it sounds like Stuart is making his plans. You know, maybe just in case he may end up somewhere overseas, just depending on how things go in November. I will say this, we have done a lot of podcasts, Jason, leading into this election year. And, you know, we've talked with, you know, rock-ribbed Republicans who haven't, you know, pushed the party away as Stuart Stevens has. And even they say, you know, like, I've got some plans just in case, you know, things get a little wild or crazy after this election. They'll tell us that off mic. So, Stuart's not the only one who's sort of toying around with ideas of, you know, what happens if.
And you think that this is alarmist and like, oh, well, you know, if these guys are going to take off if so-and-so wins. Like you said, I hear from a lot of different people who have concerns about what might happen on election day in November. But the fact that he said that, we'll call you in October or November to kind of see how things will unfold. And he said, well, if you hear that foreign ringtone, then you know, when you call like Europe or somewhere, it's just like,
yeah, it's like, dude. Yeah, it's a different ring. That's going to be interesting. And we really should try him again in October. And I am curious to see, there are no fans of Ted Cruz there at the Lincoln Project. And if you're familiar, if you haven't watched some of the Lincoln Project's ads, they're worth checking out, regardless of what your political affiliations or stripes are. These are some of the hardest hitting ads that you're going to see. These are not ads that you just see, you know, in the middle of the day on a broadcast network usually. I mean, some of these get pretty dirty. They get in there and they swing elbows and they fight.
Remember, Jason, these were Republicans. Mm-hmm. These were the ads that these guys used to make against Democrats.
Yeah.
And now
they've added a little bit to it, though. They've added a little bit of sauce to it, though. I mean, some of these are really biting.
I saw one the other day for this Trump trial the Lincoln Project produced. I don't know if you've seen that one. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. It was just absolutely brutal.
They pull no punches. So I am interested to see if they end up, you know, as he said, feeling pretty secure about those states that they're really targeting. Mm-hmm. And that if they start to perhaps look around and think, we've got a little bit left here. Maybe we go after some people like a Ted Cruz, for example. Again, they haven't been a fan of his for many years. And so I'm curious to see if they expand out, if they start to feel comfortable.
Yeah, you know, the Lincoln Project was created after Cruz was reelected in 2018. And mm-hmm. one of our most listened to episodes on this podcast was with Rick Wilson right after January 6th of 2021, when Ted Cruz was one of the senators who wanted to, I think he called for a commission to examine the votes.
Right.
And the Lincoln Project and Rick Wilson just excoriated him. For that. So
didn't hold back then either.
Didn't hold back at all. And I would like you, I'd be surprised if they don't get involved in this Cruz race and the Colin Allred race in some form or fashion. But, you know, I've heard that there are five states to watch, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Mm-hmm. But he said he didn't mention the word Nevada. Stuart didn't mention that in the podcast here. So maybe Nevada is not going to be as much of a pivotal state as we thought, you know.
And you still, I think it is going to be actually that maybe they're just not, maybe they haven't found that kind of voter there that or in concentrations worthy enough for them to really pour into that state. They're very focused this time around. But, you know, elections always teach us, you know, they spent a ton of money the last time around and they were all over the place, just sort of carpet bombing with these different hard hitting ads. They learn from elections, just like campaigns learn from elections, just like we learn from elections. And they've honed their strategy this time around. I do think it's interesting that you pronounce that other state, the old way.
Nevada.
Yeah, I think they say Nevada now.
I don't know. My wife's from California. She pronounces it whatever way she pronounces it.
I've always said Nevada too, but Nevada now I think is the way they like it. I don't know why.
Nevada?
Yeah.
But you also, what do you say? You say rural, real strange. Rural.
I say rural because it has two R's in it.
Rural.
Rural?
Yeah.
Rural.
And then you say Houston. I know that you don't pronounce the H. But
now,
whatever.
Houston, I do sound right. That one, or say right. You don't say that. You don't say the H there.
You'll defend that one. Hey, here's the last thing.
S-T-U-N.
You're right. Last thing I'll point out, and this gets into the minutia of it, but talks about the strategy, and that is the most effective messaging, he said, that they've discovered so far is, are you really this type of person where you get angry all the time?
Hmm.
And if you think about the brand that Trump is and he sells, it's that. And he's been very successful with it. Absolutely, 100%. What does he say? I'm your retribution.
Yeah, that's what grievance machine. And you know, that does get some people riled up and gets them to those rallies and gets them to those ballot boxes. It is an interesting strategy, though. And that's, again, you know, you see refinement as you go from election to election. I thought it was an interesting strategy that they're basically saying there. Usually you talk about candidate only. This time you're talking about a voter. Is this who you are?
Right.
Is this person who you are? Like, they're getting very personal there. Yeah.
They're getting personal and they're flipping it. So that's fascinating. But the Red Dawn Conservatives was a throwback to my high school for people who don't remember Red Dawn. But there was a remake of Red Dawn. I didn't see that one. The original is a classic. But the fact there are two Republicans, the dads with daughters, and then the Red Dawn Republicans. That shows you who they're going after. We'll wait and see how successful they are at it, but they've been successful in the past. They were in 2020, and we have no reason to doubt they won't be now. We may not see them as much as we did 4 years ago, But they are working hard in those four states, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. So they will be there probably tearing it up on social media.
Yeah, we're going to have to put a pin in this one and check back again in October.
We'll listen for that ringtone.
As always, everybody, thanks for listening. We'll do it all again next week.
Hey, y'all. Want to see the Jasons Talk Politics? Download the WFAA Plus streaming app for your smart TV and watch the latest episode of Y'allitics each Wednesday night at 8:30.